This is the first day of this December 2012 seven-day session. For many years, this week in December would find us in our Rohatsu session, the session in honor of the Buddha's enlightenment. And then about, I don't know, 25 years ago maybe, I switched it from December to January, because I felt that especially a seven-day during the holiday season would be... I always suspected that it was impacted by the holiday, festive holiday spirit, not to mention the pressures on people to be out shopping and partying, and then I considered that Rohatsu means the eighth day of the 12th month, and in most Japanese Zen centers that means December 8th, but really the eighth day of the 12th month means the eighth day of the 12th lunar month, which could be as late as January. And so I had the doctrinal legitimacy to change Rohatsu to January, when people, by and large, are ready to leave festive partying behind them and get back to matters of self-discipline and work. This has been shown through various studies that people are ready to start dieting again and taking up yoga or meditation. But I couldn't just let December go by without some kind of session. So we've, for many years now, we've had this as a four-day session, and we can really tune into the many, 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 many seven-day sessions that are in progress right now, ending on the 8th, December 8th, which is when we end this year, Saturday. I'm going to read from a book I've read from several times before in Sesshin, called The Original Face, and the subtitle is An Anthology of Rinzai Zen. Rinzai, most of you know, is the Japanese name of Linchi. The Linchi or Rinzai lineage is one of the two main lineages in Japan, the Rinzai, the other being the Soto. In the Rinzai tradition, the emphasis is on not on one's original enlightenment, but on one's realized enlightenment. That is, there's more emphasis by far in Rinzai, the Rinzai lineage, more emphasis on awakening to our intrinsic enlightenment than in the Soto school. The Soto school is much stronger emphasis on the fact that we have always been Buddhas. From the very beginning, all beings are Buddha. I don't think we need to preserve these sharp distinctions and sectarian distinctions. That's one of the things that attracted me to Roshi Kaplow's lineage, is that it is neither Rinzai nor Soto, but rather a kind of an integration of the two, where we certainly don't deny that we are all fundamentally enlightened. This is the fundamental truth. How could we deny it? But insist on the importance of awakening to this truth. It's a It is an anthology, as the subtitle says. And I'm going to start with Japanese Zen master Bunan, 17th century. His dates are 1603 to 1676. He trained for some 30-some years under the famous national teacher Gudo, national teacher that for most of Chinese and Japanese Zen history, there was the emperor would designate one outstanding master as the national teacher, and so Bunan's teacher Gudo was that. I'm reading here from the introduction, just a short biographical piece on him. He was a layman until his 40s. That's very unusual in these masters, these great masters. And he worked as a gatekeeper. And as a gatekeeper, he used to talk to this national teacher, Gudo, on his travels between Eastern and Western Japan. Later, Bunan left home and became a monk and an abbot of a small hermitage, and he became the foremost of Gudo's 24 Dharma heirs. Bunan had a few close disciples and a wide range of disciples and acquaintances. We're told here that he left a great deal of inspiration and guidance in Japanese poetry and booklets in prose and verse. He was naturally austere. We'll hear that as we read the selections from his teaching. He was naturally austere and led his group with a few simple rules. And finally, it's said that he couldn't even read the difficult Chinese classic texts. Well, you don't have to be able to read to come to awakening. And these are selections of various lengths from his teaching. Fire is something that burns. Water is something that wets. A Buddha is someone who practices compassion. Here, the word Buddha is used to mean someone who has awakened to her true nature. A Buddha is someone who practices compassion. If we have truly realized this Buddha nature, which means that if we realize that in our true nature we are endowed with all compassion as well as wisdom, then this compassion will flow. A Buddha is someone who practices compassion. He goes on, teaching people to be kind and compassionate to others means imitating the Buddha. I don't know if imitating is the best translation there. Generally, the word imitate has a pejorative meaning, at least in Zen, where you're going through the motions, imitating someone else, but without the real spirit of it. But I think maybe let's make it this. Teaching people to be kind and compassionate to others means functioning like the Buddha. If you just practice compassion, you will certainly become good. And he goes on, the basis of compassion is purity of the mind. Purity of the mind is, quote, not a single thing. Not a single thing means nothing at all. It is beyond the reach of speech, beyond affirmation and negation. Let's just pause here. So in Zen, rather than trying to create the effect of being compassionate or trying self-consciously to be a compassionate person, it really comes down to emptying the mind of everything that obstructs the natural flow of our innate compassion. Here we can distinguish it from metta meditation. Metta means loving kindness. It's a kind of Buddhist meditation. In metta meditation, one makes the effort to radiate loving kindness. That's the object of the meditation. You have the aim of radiating loving kindness through the use of words or images, words and images sometimes, and it's a wonderful practice, especially if you've learned to concentrate the mind through Zen. Then it becomes a lot easier to generate that kind of loving kindness. But Zen goes at it quite differently. Always in Zen, we're not trying to create an effect of any kind. We're not trying to be compassionate. We're not trying to be wise. We're not trying to be helpful. But rather, we go beyond all of these intentions and through the breath or the koan, shikantaza, through whatever our practice is, we empty the mind, and in doing so, we create the space or the freedom to act out of our, take your pick, compassion, wisdom, virtue. So this approach, which in a way is not even an approach of Zen, rests on the most basic faith that we have never been without compassion. No matter how nasty we may be in our lives, no matter how self-centered, unresponsive to others who are in pain, still, compassion is our nature. If we could just strip the mind of the fetters that prevent us from that compassion from flowing. So it's a matter of letting thoughts settle. That's what we're doing this week. So we do every time we cross our legs. We're settling the body mind, letting thoughts settle, and then with the mind open, clear, expansive, we experience our indivisibility with other beings. And out of that experience of oneness, non-separation, that's really the source of compassionate action or compassionate response. But it all comes down to this mind of no-thingness, or the translator puts in quotes here, not a single thing. This is a very advanced state to reach, where there's no clinging to thought, no pursuit of thought in the mind. Doesn't mean there's no thought. Just means we're not involved with the little background thought activity that is part of the functioning of the brain. But just to repeat this one sentence, he says, not a single thing means nothing at all. It is beyond the reach of speech, beyond affirmation and negation. If there is any affirmation or negation in your heart will be obstructed by that affirmation and negation. If there is no affirmation or negation, then heaven and earth are one. If there is something, meaning in the mind, it separates you from heaven. This you should well understand. These terms, affirmation and negation, are awfully philosophical words, but they, you find them all through the Buddhist canon, Buddhist texts, not getting caught in either yes or no, this or that. Of course, those are very broad terms that apply just about to anything. A parent, for example, might that might play out in terms of hearing pleas from their children. Mom, can I da 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 da? Or I'm going out to da da da. I want to go out da 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 da. Where the parent then has to face the difficulty of saying either yes or no. What Zen would say is that if we're not attached to positions of yes or no, then that parent will know how to respond. The key thing is not to be attached to notions, positions, stances. Of course, it's the same with any kind of teaching or mentoring. And a lot of other things where we face decisions in our personal lives, our relationships, to respond without mental attachments is what will find us most likely in harmony with this true nature of ours. And then he presents, Bunan presents a little verse, the mind which knows nothing is a Buddha by a different name. Again, the richness, the wisdom of an empty mind. Socrates once said, wisdom begins in wonder, not knowing. Of course, there are plenty of times and situations where we are called upon to know something, a fact or something else. And at such times, then we can't try to escape into this teaching of knowing nothing. But in matters of great importance, to respond from a mind that is beyond knowledge, beyond ideas. That's what it really means. It's free. It's not shackled by ideas and concepts. This is when our Buddha nature is most likely to be functioning freely. It's the mind of a fool. Capital F. Capital F fool. He goes on, since you will surely eventually die, you should set your mind diligently on the way of enlightenment. This is an important sentence. Since you will surely eventually die. We all know this, but we know it all too often. We know it in a somewhat superficial way. Yeah, of course, we all die. Mm-hmm. Pass the bread. It is I come to believe it's quite a rare thing for someone to really know this, to really feel it. The certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death. In a way, this is the linchpin of all serious aspiration. To face the fact that we're like fish in a pond that is being steadily drained. Some people may think that's overly dramatic. I don't. As we age, things like that don't sound so overly dramatic. As we see the sands of time draining through the hourglass. Fortunate is the young person who feels this, knows that it's just a matter of time. There is no better fuel for practice. There's a great Buddhist monk by the name of Shantideva who put it this way, that which is not dear to me will not be, and that which is dear to me will not be, and I will not be, and all will not be. And then to encounter a practice, not a philosophy, a practice that through which we can come to terms with this matter of life and death. What a blessing. What an opportunity. He goes on, there is no enlightened Buddha outside your own heart. Always keep a pure and clean mind and heart. This is unusual. And this is not the usual Zen style of making this kind of didactic statements about what you should do. I guess we need to trust the translator. For those of you who don't know, there is the Chinese and Japanese languages are so wide open to different interpretations, different translations. You get the barest information from the characters that are laid out. So, but let's take the spirit of this. That's the important thing. He's saying, always keep a pure and clean mind and heart. Well, in Zen terms, this means don't traffic in thoughts. Don't waste time dwelling in this dusty world of thoughts. And then he says, when thoughts of your own body come up, as long as such thoughts are always there, this life lasts but a little while, and you will fall into a hell and suffer forever and ever. Hell, in Buddhism, hell is not just a place you go to after death and stay in forever, but it just means circumstances of great pain, great suffering. And we know there are plenty of people, unfortunately, great throngs of people suffering while they're alive, and we can call that hell. The hells we read about in the news, in other countries, sometimes in our own country. These poor wretches who go into schools or workplaces and start firing. Not only are they creating a terrible karma for themselves, but to even do that, they have to be in some kind of hell already, before walking in with their firearms. He's warning here, and this is another distinct thing about Bunan's teaching, and because it's so explicit. Other teachers will warn about being attached to the demands of the body for sleep and sex and food, and warning of the attachments to these things. But Bunan seems to emphasize them more. When thoughts of your own body come up, as long as such thoughts are always there, this life lasts but a little while and you fall into hell. Well, of course, he's warning about vanity. This doesn't mean that there's not a place for grooming oneself in a sensible kind of way. But I think as lay people, we can take this to mean not overdoing it, not getting caught up in appearance, our own appearance. In Sesshin, we have find that we have the freedom to let go of such things more easily without mirrors around in Sesshin. Thoughts of your own body. We live in an age when this has become a terrible burden to most people, maybe. Maybe that's not unfair to say most people are caught in concerns of body image and appearance and ideas of better and worse and good and bad. They say that cosmetic surgery just continues to proliferate more and more. And then it's always a matter of the measure, the proportion. Doesn't mean we can't use combs and choose clothing that appeals to us and that we think will appeal to others, but not being obsessed by it. It's a terrible state of bondage to be in that state. And that's one of the things that slips, that fades through long practice, is we just lose such extreme self-concern. And how does that happen? Why is it through long practice such concerns bother us less and less? Because we learn not to dwell in our thoughts. That's what binds us to suffering, is dwelling in our thoughts about ourselves, about others, ourselves compared to others. Not just appearance, but thoughts of our practice. That's a big one. Thoughts about our practice compared to others' practices. It's all self and other when you get right down to it. And then at the end of this little passage, after he says, if you're dwelling in your thoughts, you'll fall into hell and suffer, then he says, but even leaving that aside, in this life you will suffer in many ways. I think this statement, this fact, was so much more self-evident in the 17th century of Bunan's life than it is today. We have devised so many ways of avoiding suffering. Of course, we can never really get away from it, because we will find ways to suffer, even if we can shut away these three sights that Siddhartha encountered on the road when he left the palace: sickness, old age, and death. Even though we may be able to keep all those things at a distance and keep our head turned away from them, avoiding people who are very old, avoiding people who are sick, avoiding the dying, still there is this troublemaker, the mind, will find a way to create frustration, dissatisfaction. Here's just an isolated sentence. He says, it is easy to keep things at a distance. It is hard to be naturally beyond them. It's easy to keep things at a distance. One kind of modern spin on this, interpretation of this, is it's easy enough to suppress things in the mind. It's easy enough to suppress emotions or feelings, such as anger, sorrow, fear, anxiety. Then he says it's hard to be naturally beyond them, to be able to really get free of them, not just suppress them, but to get free of them. This is the hard thing. When I read this statement, what came to mind was a passage that I was told is in the Bible, attributed to Jesus. If you do not bring forth what is in you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. If you do bring forth what is in you, what you do bring forth will save you. Even on a psychological level, that is a call to self-awareness. We can't live full lives so long as we have sealed off parts of ourselves, parts of our emotional life, and are afraid to face them. Well, Sashin ensures that if we go to enough of them, we will be facing them. We can't keep things suppressed forever while coming to Sashin. Just doing daily zazen, well, we can hold out longer. We can keep things tucked away longer. But in the intensity of doing 10 or more hours a day of sitting in Sashin with the help of so many other people, we are sure, sooner or later, to encounter whatever shadows we have tried to keep at a distance, and are encountering them, facing them, is what will free us of them. Here's another very short one he offers. While deluded, one is used by this body. When enlightened, one uses this body. So, when we have not yet seen the illusory nature of self, this also means the illusory nature of the body and the mind. When we have not yet seen that, then we are more susceptible to the dictates of the body. We are more likely to be driven by our cravings for food, driven by our cravings for sex, driven by our cravings for sleep. After awakening, we still may face challenges in these realms of food and sex and sleep, but we're more likely now to be in the driver's seat. Now instead of food and sex and sleep driving us, now we're at the wheel. We still may have those as passengers, but now we have more of a choice in the matter of whether we are going to act out of these cravings or see them for what they are, which is just transitory phenomena, transitory states. Same with emotional states. When we are still caught in notions of self, we are more likely to fall prey to states of anxiety, of fear, of anger, of depression. After awakening, we still can experience periods of anxiety, of even depression, certainly anger. But now our relationship to these experiences are changed. Our relationship to these emotional states is different. Now we see them for what they are: transitory phenomena, passing states. And that's everything. When we feel gripped by some painful and difficult emotion, to have the presence of mind to recognize, to remember anyway, that it will pass, gives us some measure of freedom. The same with desires. We don't have to be pushed around by our desires. If we have the presence of mind in the grip of a craving or desire, to remember, to remind ourselves that it will pass, then there too we have some room in which to work with it, not give way to it. Here's a funny little section that is titled, Things People Are Always Wrong About. And he lists them. We'll probably just get to the first one or two, but I'll start it. The first is hating to be fooled by others while liking to be fooled by oneself. Hating to be fooled by others. Who wants to be deceived by others? Who wants to be a sucker to others? But being deceiving oneself, that's on a different matter, he's saying. Actually, I would suggest that it's when we're deceiving ourselves, we're not aware of it. It's not like we like being deceived by ourselves. We don't know we're being deceived. We're deceiving ourselves. The essence of meditation, and I think this may be true of any kind of meditation, but certainly Zen, the essence of Zen is awareness. And this means self-awareness and awareness of what we think of as outside ourselves. And luckily, we get better and better at this awareness. We get onto ourselves. We more quickly notice when we're deceiving ourselves through practice, through ongoing practice. We become more aware. We notice things in the mind that we didn't used to notice. We notice things outside ourselves, things around us, our surroundings, our environment, the conditions, the circumstances we're in. We come to notice them more readily. And we notice when we've been fooling ourselves, let's put it that way, when we have been fooling ourselves. And we learn not to fall for that in the future. It usually takes about 10,000 trials of going through and being fooled again and again. But eventually, we catch it in time. Not to be snared by the devices of the mind. All right, let's... before we go to the four vows, I wanted to suggest or mention an ongoing problem with the pacing of the four vows. This became quite dramatic last night when we ended at 9:30 last night and we recited the four vows. We just about went off the rails in a way I haven't heard in a long time. The monitors and I puzzled over this later, what went wrong. It was all disjointed. It may be partly how much we're spaced apart in this giant zendo with this relatively small sesshin. But there's nothing we can do about that. So just a little review of the pacing of the four vows. We want to recite these vows with solemnity, but not let them drag, not let them get too lethargic, too sluggish. So there are four lines in the four vows, and they're mostly in pairs of words. But not entirely. That's why it gets it gets kind of tricky. So look at the first line. There are four pairs. All beings without number, I bow to liberate. Now, the spacing between those pairs is what's tricky, because we don't want it to get too much space, but also not too little. And that's why this has been a persistent problem for as long as I've been at the center. We recently, the staff, drilled this just a few days ago. We went through this, the pacing of it. That's why it's especially ironic that everything went to pot last night. And then it's the second and fourth lines where that pairing doesn't hold up. So in the second line, you take the first three words. Endless blind passions, I vow to uproot. And then the third line, again, pairs. Dharma gates beyond measure, I vow to penetrate. And then the last line is the hardest, because those first four words are spaced out evenly. The great way of Buddha, the great way of Buddha. Our tendency has always been to open up this huge space after the word the and after the word of. Like the, and people's minds are in a thousand different places, just letting it drag out. The great way of Buddha. So it's hard, but let's work at it together. The great way of Buddha, not rushed, no. The great way of Buddha, I vow to attain. And now we'll all recite the four vows together.